This is The Book in the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
The history of writing is intertwined with the history of the Bible, particularly the development of alphabetic writing. Since we began this program 40 years ago, the development of the alphabet has been pushed back by several hundred years to about 1800 BC. And that kind of challenges those archaeologists and Bible scholars who believe the Bible was written down in the first millennium BC. Could Moses have actually written portions of the Bible with which he is credited? The historicity of Moses is our topic today as we talk with Mark Jansen, an Egyptologist and professor of archaeology at Lipscomb University. Mark, archaeologists typically say we don't have a lot of archaeological evidence about Moses.
Yeah, there is some accuracy to the idea that we don't have direct physical evidence. So the first thing I always try to tell people in these contexts is it is true we don't have direct physical evidence from Egypt of Moses. In other words, we don't have Moses was here on a rock or anything directly on a temple wall or something like that. But that's really easy to explain, and the simple truth being the Egyptians don't talk about people like Moses very often, and the archaeological evidence that is often cited as proof that he's fictitious or something along those lines is sometimes overstated, as there hasn't really been that many excavations in the Delta where the Israelites were. And there's been almost no actual excavations in Sinai, just surface surveys where someone's walking and just kind of seeing what's there. And so this idea that there's no evidence needs to be contextualized with what the research has actually been. And some of that's political realities and logistics, and it's very obviously difficult to excavate in Sinai, for example. So what we have instead is what I like to call just circumstantial evidence, evidence that requires a circumstance to explain its existence. And here's where we now would then turn to scripture. And there we see things like the six loan words from Egyptian hieroglyphs in the account of Moses's birth. And these are mundane words like reed and rushes and things like that. So why are those authentically Egyptian terms in the Hebrew text if they're making it all up later? How do they know all this? It's these authentic Egyptianisms, we could call them. And there's more than just that, but that sort of is an intro. So we have circumstantial evidence, I would say, more so than archaeological. But the absence of the archaeological evidence may not be as problematic as it's often stated.
What would be some of the other circumstantial evidence for Moses?
Well, there'd be things like, oh, well, why would Pharaoh's daughter raise him in the court of Pharaoh? That seems too good to be true, right? Well, it's actually what they did in Egypt from the New Kingdom from the 18th dynasty until the end of their empire phase. They would actually bring, so say, 1550-ish down to about 1200, 1150, we'll just say for easy math, they would bring back the children of the rulers in places like Syria, Palestine that they had conquered, and they will raise them up in the Egyptian court. It's basically the equivalent of Egyptian diplomacy school. They're trained to do things the Egyptian way, and then they will send them back to rule on Egypt's behalf, hopefully curbing rebellion, because the locals get a so-called local, the son of the last guy, but the Egyptians get someone who knows their way of doing things. So actually, Moses would just be another Semite among a bunch of Semites in the New Kingdom. And that fits either early or late date Exodus too, by the way.
So those would be locals who have been Egyptianized.
Yes.
Basically. So we've talked about the Amarna letters a lot of times, these letters that were sent from different cities in Canaan to the Egyptian pharaoh. Does that fit into that picture?
It does.
Kings of different cities in correspondence because maybe their sons were in the Egyptian court being raised by the pharaoh.
Yeah, it does fit. Now, I would say Amarna predates Moses. I date Moses to the reign of Ramses, so I'm a late date in terms of the terminology, but we don't need to get into that really. But those letters do fit the context. And we see stuff like there was one Aziru of Amuru, and that's where he's from. Amuru, his name was Aziru. And he says, and I have the quote here, "I herewith give my sons as two attendants, and they are to do what the king, my lord, orders." So we even have the rulers sending them sometimes like, here, take them, right? It's obvious diplomacy, tried and true, keeps the peace by having children in the foreign court. Then we have another official whose name was Abdiel or Aper-El, sometimes it's translated, who refers to himself in his tomb, he's a Semite, Aper-El, theophoric, one of the names for God. So he's more Semitic than you could possibly imagine. And he says in his tomb that he was the child of the nursery, meaning that same sort of royal training ground. And he actually rose all the way to rank of vizier, which we would basically say is second in command, even as a foreigner. So a lot of this whole Moses is too good to be true stuff just doesn't work when you know the ancient textual data.
The influence of Moses, according to the Bible, is huge in the biblical mm-hmm. story. Does that information in the Bible about Moses match what archaeology has revealed about the culture of ancient Egypt?
Yeah, so I think it matches the culture of Egypt well. There's a lot of authentic Egyptianisms, even stuff like the description of the Ark of the Covenant. Probably the best parallels to that item are the different chests found in the Tomb of Tutankhamun. And then we also see in the iconographic record things that look vaguely similar to the Ark. It's certainly more Egyptian than it is Babylonian, for example. And so this age-old idea that they sort of make up this origin story while they're living in exile or maybe just before, I think stretches credulity when you look at all the authentic New Kingdom Egypt things going on. David Falk has a really good book on this, on the Ark and the Tabernacle and all the influences of Egypt. That's David Falk, F-A-L-K. I think it's just called The Ark of the Covenant. I can't remember the title of it exactly off the top of my head. So there's been some research on that by, you know, PhD level. And he's an Egyptologist as well, as a fellow Christian. The other thing I think is worth pointing out as far as the sort of Egyptianisms, and then we'll come to the picture of Moses again, is in Exodus 1:11, which mentions the store cities that the Israelites built, we have Pithom and Ramses. Every Egyptologist agrees essentially that Ramses is Pi Ramses in Egyptian sources. It just means house of Ramses. Biblical data is just called Ramses, but it's the same idea. This city was only used for about 150 years because the branch of the Nile that it was built on dried up. That meant by about 1130, it was no longer there, and they moved the blocks, reused the blocks at Tanis. Good little recyclers, the Egyptians. Later biblical texts that we know date later, like Psalm 78 or 105, refer to it as Tanis because that's the town at their time, right? It's like 10 miles north. But in Exodus, they call it Pi Ramses, not Tanis. Well, why would they do that if Exodus was written later? How do they know that it was Pi Ramses when it was only Pi Ramses for a century and a half? It's a really good marker of authenticity. And at the very least suggests that the writing is based on good sources that have their details right, or it was written much earlier.
For those who have just joined us, we're talking with Mark Jensen, an Egyptologist and professor of archaeology at Lipscomb University, about the historicity of Moses. Some people have described Moses' birth story as kind of legendary, plucked out of the Nile River by the daughter of the Pharaoh. Are there other examples of stories like that in the ancient world?
There are. And let's be honest, before we get any further, there are certain parts of the biblical data that are miraculous. One of my passions is to help people understand the sort of plausibility of the biblical account. But we also need to not do that to the extreme to where we limit the role that Yahweh plays. But I think even the miracles are mostly about scope and timing, right? Like the plagues, they're all natural phenomenon except the last one, right? They're just sort of exaggerated and they happen, you know, snap your fingers right when Moses and, you know, is telling them. So I don't want to dismiss the miraculous, but I do find it more plausible than a lot of the academic treatments in the past have stated. Now, Jim Hoffmeyer's book is excellent, Israel and Egypt. He's got a revised version coming out. That's the definitive book on this. I also have a book that I edited that involves Scott Stripling, Jim Hoffmeyer, Gary Rensberg, Ron Hendel. And there I have them basically debate issues in the Exodus called Five Views on the Exodus. So the scholarship is starting to be, I think, a bit more nuanced with it, which I think is a good thing. But as for the birth, and the reason I brought all that up beforehand is, yeah, there's elements of the birth story that do seem miraculous, right? Like this baby surviving in a basket on a river, right? I just was watching Prince of Egypt with my kids the other day, and the one hadn't seen it yet. She's seven, and she's like, why are they doing that? Why would you put your baby in the river? Like, she was very upset. Even a child's like, wow, this is dangerous, right? Like, you recognize right away that the Lord's hand must be on him to survive this thing. And we don't want to completely dismiss that. There has been much ink spilled on the birth narrative because of the legend of Sargon, which is an Akkadian text written in the 6th or 7th century BC. And like Moses, Sargon of Akkad was placed by his mother in a waterproof basket shortly after birth, set adrift in a river, and miraculously saved by, you know, someone of elite status. Both accounts are usually dismissed as legendary, right? But I don't think that necessarily needs to be the case. Another Egyptologist, Kenneth Kitchen, who's very famous, at least amongst Egyptologists and biblical scholars, has done a number of things on all of this. And he says, you know, whether the infancy in that story is legendary or not, Sargon was a real person. Right? You wouldn't dismiss him as a historical figure just because of the birth narrative. So why are we doing that with Moses? They both have a text that references this. They're both presented as great leaders. Again, if this is a point we already made, but if Moses' story is copying Sargon's, why do we have the Egyptian words for very mundane things? It'd be one thing for them to know the word Pharaoh. Everybody wouldn't have known the word Pharaoh, right? But to know the Egyptian word for reeds, that suggests to me that they were in Egypt to get that kind of firsthand knowledge. Like if it's a copy of Akkadian text, you'd expect Akkadian loan words, right? Not Egyptian.
So Moses has put together, according to the Bible, this great legal code, the Torah. Mm-hmm. I guess there's probably a lot of questions about whether Moses could have actually done something like that. We have the Code of Hammurabi, which goes back roughly the same period of time. Mm-hmm. Is it beyond imagination that Moses, writing in the desert on his way to Israel, could have put together this code that is in the five books of the Old Testament, the Torah?
I don't think it's that hard to believe. Writing, of course, goes back earlier than Moses, even in sort of pseudo-alphabetic, though there's a lot of debate about where Hebrew comes in, and I don't want to get into the weeds on that one, as I don't consider myself an expert there. The general idea for skeptics has been that these are primitive people. If the story is true and they've been enslaved by the Egyptians, how could they possibly write all this? Like they wouldn't be culturally advanced or what have you enough to do that. But it really, Moses is sort of the perfect guy for this in a certain way because of his upbringing in the court of Pharaoh. We just are circling back to that basic point. Again, Kitchen's done a lot of work on the structure of the covenant, and he's compared it to other ancient documents. And one of the main places that we see parallels to the covenant in Exodus is from the Hittites in the 14th, 13th century. They were in diplomatic relations with the Egyptians at the time. And so I think that's very interesting to just kind of note, like Moses might have been, this is very speculative at this point, but he might have been familiar with some of that as part of his upbringing.
Raised in the court of an 18th dynasty Egyptian pharaoh, Moses would have had access to the best education possible of that era. Perfect training for the kind of leader described in the first five books of the Bible. We'll continue our conversation on the historicity of Moses with Mark Jansen in our next program. Mark is an Egyptologist and professor of archaeology at Lipscomb University and also is involved with a podcast on biblical archaeology. We have a link to On Script, The Biblical World on our website and also to the book Mark edited, Five Views of the Exodus. Go there also to find out how to subscribe to our biblical archaeology news magazine, Artifacts, and for details of our 2024 Israel study trip. That's all at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier, inviting you back next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through biblical archaeology on The Book in the Spade.
The Book in the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.